aid as humanism, generalizations about the scope of this thing called humanism. I mentioned to you that the book by Louis Spitz on the humanists of Germany, a book that I would certainly encourage you to read, The Religious Renaissance of the German Humanists, perhaps the most recent book on this subject. Another very fine book on humanism is the book by Kristeller, K-I-S-T-E-L-L-E-R, The Classics and Renaissance Thought, 1955. Kristeller draws some of the most provocative conclusions in his discussion of humanism, in this that he designates humanism as essentially a curricular matter. We have always thought of humanism as more or less a university phenomena, but we have had thought of it previously in the earlier histories as something that was essentially secularistic, and this is what characterized it. That is, it was Middle Ages versus Renaissance. Middle Ages was the age of piety. Renaissance is the age of impiety. When you talked about humanism, you thought of men like Boccaccio and Rabelais, or the Platonists in Florence. The impious or the pious, the non-pious. Kristeller suggests that if this is the case, then the distinction between Middle Ages and Renaissance is not at all clear. Because, first of all, most of the humanists were pious. An analysis of their writings as well as their personal stance indicates this. And secondly, if you take the other side of the coin, you can find the same kind of skepticism or a-piety in the Middle Ages, in the medieval university, just as you can in the so-called Renaissance university. Kristeller then suggests that essentially humanism was a new kind of educational curriculum, one that did not emphasize what the medieval scholastic curriculum emphasized, that is, logic, philosophy, and metaphysics, mainly. So this is what you studied at a university like Oxford or Paris. And the emphasis would definitely be on logical analysis, in the scholastic sense, of course. When a university is said to be inclining toward humanism, or the instruction there is said to be moving in the humanistic direction, this means that in the universities there is a greater emphasis on the use of ancient tools, the study of ancient manuscripts, classical texts. But Kristeller points out, not only classical text in the sense that you copy Homer or copy Plato, which was done, of course, but also classical in the sense that you are interested in the classical Christian manuscripts, that is, the actual letters of Paul or the Gospels, rather than studying Paul or the Gospels through the dogmatics, the sentences of Lombard as interpreted by commentators, in Luther's case, someone like Occam or Beale. This was the more scholastic, the medieval way of doing it. Now the emphasis is on going back to the original texts, to learn Greek again, the humanists, to study the Greek, to study the Hebrew, in order to get at the original text of the Old Testament. And then, secondly, there is a great emphasis on history. This doesn't mean too much. when compared to the modern emphasis on historical analysis since the 19th century. But it is a much greater emphasis on history as such, the growth of things, than had been true in the medieval university. When they studied the Roman and the Greek classics, as well as the Christian classics, they were interested in what happened, documents portray. And then, thirdly, ethics. You have quite a number of the humanists, men like Pico in Italy, Colette in England, Erasmus in England, and then in Rotterdam, or in Louvain, all of whom write systematic theologies. I suppose that's the way you would have to classify them, but they are anything but systematic in the traditional sense. They are theology, but in a much more theology where ethics, the way of Christian living, the education of a Christian prince, this kind of thing, is emphasized to a much greater degree than it is, say, in scholastic theology. Now, the humanists themselves were convinced, according to Christeller, that theirs was a momentous turning point in history. That they were that they were a revolution. This is the Renaissance vis-a-vis the Middle Ages, or the Enlightenment vis-a-vis all that precedes the Enlightenment. These groups always think of themselves in that way. Christeller suggests that it is far less than that. That the seeds of this can be traced way back into the Middle Ages. Into the 12th century at least, the seeds of it, that's all, and that conversely, these men were revolutionists only in the sense that they were revising the university curriculum, not in the sense that they believed in an altogether new way of life, or had an altogether different Weltanschauung, as will come about in, say, to a much greater degree in the Enlightenment, and certainly although here again, perhaps because we are part of something, we tend to think of it the same way they thought of it, those who thought of it when they were part of it. When we think of modern logical positivism and logical analysis pragmatism as being revolutionary outlooks on life, perhaps they will ultimately turn out to be something less. In other words, and mainly though, this is what Christeller has to say about the scope of humanism, and I think it's worth looking at to begin with. Then there is another book that I would like to recommend, especially as an introductory reading, and also because it's in paperback. I assume it is available in the bookstore. It's by Harbison, H-A-R-B-I-S-O-N, The Christian Scholar in the Age of the Reformation. These are biographical studies, primarily, but this is what humanism is, really. The story of the viewpoints of certain scholars that characterize the intellect of an age. And this is what Harbison attempts to capture, and I think you'll find it very interesting, moving all the way from men like Erasmus and Pico to men like Martin Luther and John Calvin. These are all the scholars of the Reformation. The Reformation, whether it is in Germany, or in England, or in Geneva, or in France, wherever it is, comes out of the universities. And for this reason, you can, as Harbison does, simply speak of the Christian scholar in this period and include both the Renaissance and the Reformation, because humanism pervades both of them. Now, a number of examples then that I think will more or less demonstrate what this thing stands for and how it varies. At least the shades of it vary as you move from area to area. First of all, Italian humanism. We normally think of this as the Renaissance. One of the most important of these humanists, of course, is Petrarch. Two men that are very important because they were part of the Platonic Academy in Florence, which is important not only as part of the Renaissance, but also because it produced, or at least participates in the education of so many of the Renaissance, of the Reformation figures. And the two men that are important there are Ficino and Pico della Mirandola. The names, I have them on your outline. Here you have this return to the study of Greek, classical Greek manuscripts, translating, for example, the dialogues of Plato into Latin. There's a very fine book just on this by Cassirer, The Renaissance Philosophy of Man, if you want to do some work in that particular area. These men are perhaps less important for the Reformation in Wittenberg, but they are very important for the Reformation in Geneva, say, Calvin's Reformation, or the Reformation in Paris, the source of Calvin's Reformation. Here, the Platonic Academy plays a very important and strong role. Many of the men who were active alongside of Zwingli and Calvin had been educated at the Platonic Academy in Florence, in the Renaissance. Then, of course, Lorenzo Valla. You can hardly overestimate his importance, because Luther is so familiar with the accents of Valla and his immediate predecessors in manuscript study. We mentioned Nicholas of Cusa. He, of course, had worked on many of these things prior to Valla. It's usually Valla, however, that gets the credit for them. And Luther is familiar with all of this material. Valla was critical of the Vulgate. It was a poor translation. And this, of course, is based primarily on his manuscript study, and quite often on the use of manuscripts that Jerome didn't use. What makes it a poor version? Valla suggests that the apostles did not write the Apostles' Creed. Demonstrates this, thus reversing the 4th century Christian scholar Rufinus, who believed that they did. He is the one who discredits Dionysius, the writings that went under the name of Dionysius the Areopagite, as being pseudo-Dionysius. He is the one who discredits, as we all know, the donation of Constantine. He shows that those letters that are credited to that correspondence that is supposed to have issued between our Lord and Abgar, that Eusebius gives us in the first book of his Ecclesiastical History, is not authentic. Erasmus will translate Valla's notes for a translator or for a reader on the language of the New Testament, Valla's annotations on the New Testament. These will be translated into Latin. I'm sorry. No. He wrote them that way. It's Erasmus who publishes them and circularizes them, and via this process they are then used by other individuals, especially Roy Kleen in his study of the Old Testament. So that here you have a man from the Italian Renaissance, or from Italian humanism, that is extremely important for the understanding of Martin Luther as a translator. He is familiar with all of the accents that occur in the writings of this humanist, Valla. Valla, of course, was the master of the Vatican Library in Rome, curiously enough. Then, in Spain, that should be Alcala, or Alcala, A-L-C-A-L-A. Now, this was the university that was established in Spain. Again, emphasizing the study of the Bible qua Bible, rather than Bible in the tradition of the scholastic commentaries on it. That very famous polyglot Bible is printed in 1522, which gives the Bible in six different forms: Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, parts of it, of course, sections from the Targums, the Septuagint, and the Vulgate. This was done by Cardinal Ximenes, X-I-M-E-N-E-S. I think I have that on there. No, I don't. X-I-M-E-N-E-S. He dies in 1517. So here, too, you have a study of the Bible, but it's studied primarily, the emphasis is on getting at the proper text to find out what Paul says or what Moses says textually. The emphasis is not as it is in Luther, for example, in finding to find out what Paul says in order to find a gracious God. This is not an accent at all in the work of the scholars at Alcala. Then in France, you have a similar movement. This is very important. At the University of Paris, the important figure there is Jacques Lefebvre de Tap, or as he was called, Stapulensis, a man with an amazing mind, at least what his associates said of him. He dies in 1536. You have this, Lefebvre approaches the study of at Paris, the theological study, in the same way. He's preoccupied with the originals and with getting good texts of the originals. And this leads him, for example, to write a commentary on the Psalms that does not follow the scholastic method of commentating, of commentary, but simply attempts to get at the most accurate reading of the text. Unfortunately, Stapulensis's commentary is too often preoccupied with Plato and Aristotle. He's also quite familiar with their texts, and attempts to, unfortunately, find them too often, even so, in the Psalms. Lefebvre stresses Bible study with this accent. Writes commentaries not only on the Psalms, but also on Paul's epistles, on the Gospels, 1512 and 1522. This is before Luther is any great influence in France. You can't credit this to him. And then he also, in 1525, publishes a French translation of the New Testament. Now, the disciples of De Tap were men like Brinsonnet, B-R-I-N-C-O-N-N-E-T, who is one of the leaders of Protestantism in France, the background of the Huguenots, whom you'll take up in Church History 3. It shows how closely humanism here is tied into the Reformation movement in France. And then Jerome Farel, who is the man who actually captures Calvin for Geneva. When Farel attempts to bring about some of the reform movements in Geneva and is unable to accomplish them, he prevails upon Calvin to stay and help him, so that it's Calvin who ultimately becomes the great reformer. But Farel was a very important influence in this. The humanistic thrust in the commentaries, in the writings of Calvin, comes very definitely from Paris through this man. Farel needed someone, well, we'll be talking about this next week, but I think it's interesting. Farel needed someone in Geneva to help him with this grand Reformation movement there of purifying the church.
And Calvin was in the midst of writing his Dogmatics, and consequently didn't want to spend time with something so irritating as leading people into the scriptures and away from the heresy that both of them found in Scholasticism. And it's only when Farrell suggests that if Calvin is not willing to stay in Geneva, that his Dogmatics might well be damned, that Calvin agrees to stay, and consequently becomes the man that we know him, as we know him. Again, at Oxford, you have something quite similar. This humanistic accent in the university, in this case at Oxford, out of which the men come in England who are influenced by Luther as well as by Calvin, and become the foundation then for what we know today as the Anglican Church. There's a direct relationship here. One of the most important of these individuals is John Collett, C-O-L-E-T. There's a very fine article on this man by Professor Meyer in the July CTM of last year. Collett was part of what I suppose we would call the Divinity School at Oxford. And he gave the lectures on Bible, and it's in the process of doing this that he introduces the humanistic tradition. Not introduces it, but he introduces it into his own lectures, at least as at Oxford. There were others there before him whose names we don't have to worry about for the present. But here too, when Collett lectured and then wrote these lectures out, these commentaries on Paul's epistles, you have very definitely in this material an accent on Paul's theology of grace. But this wasn't the primary motivation in the commentaries of Collett. He is much more interested in getting a kind of universally recognized Christianity, comparing Christianity to natural religion, I suppose we would say. These are the accents in which he is primarily interested, those things about Christianity to which all could agree. But the other is also there. It's just that it's not so important for Collett. Other than this humanistic tradition of getting a kind of universally recognized Christianity, putting Christianity, spelling Christianity out in terms of the religion of man, the other accent in his commentaries is what does the text say? In contrast to the allegorization of the text among the scholastics. I think that in the commentaries of men like John Collett and John Calvin later on, you have a much more grammatical, an emphasis on the grammar, on the literal, the sensus literalis, than you have in Luther. Because Luther is not as deeply influenced by the humanistic tradition of reading the text as the text speaks. As these men are, I think all you have to do is read Luther on the Psalms or read Luther on Genesis, and this will need no more demonstration for you. Secondly, Collett was interested in a textual criticism, word studies, word usages, that kind of thing, and then also the text criticism specifically, that is the best text of a given author in the New Testament. One of his associates for a time at Oxford was Erasmus, whose whose efforts are quite similar. He comes from Rotterdam. Erasmus is a product of the Brethren of the Common Life. That's where he studied as a young man at the Venter. Then he goes to Oxford, where he teaches for a while, and then ultimately ends up at the University of Louvain, one of those universities that ultimately condemned Luther. Erasmus, of all of these men that we have been mentioning, I suppose, is most familiar to you. But unfortunately, in our circles, Erasmus is too often criticized on the basis of presuppositions that are Lutheran rather than humanistic. And this is perhaps a bit unfair. In other words, what I'm referring to primarily is the assertion that Erasmus was a coward because he would not go along with Luther. I have always found this very difficult to digest. And after you read the writings of the man and study his approach to the study of religion, and I say it that way because I think that's really what it was in Erasmus, rather than theology or Christology in the traditional sense, all he is doing when he refuses to ally with Luther is saying that this is not what I stand for. It has nothing to do with whether or not he was a coward. He admits, as you probably know, at one time, if this is an authentic saying of his, that he didn't think he had any martyr's blood in him. But this is based on a whole outlook that thought of the task of theology as something other than producing educated martyrs. For he felt that to drive the authorities by such extreme propositions of the kind that Luther was enunciating would only drive them to persecution, which would destroy not only Luther, but also humanism. In other words, education would be set back a couple of decades or more, and all of the reforms that the humanists had accomplished in many universities in Europe would be thrown out, becoming subject to the Inquisition. If you want to refer to Erasmus as cautious, fine. I think this would be true, but I think a coward is a bit strong, because to ally with Luther would have carried Erasmus into a kind of theological stance with which he simply did not agree. He was not willing to die for Luther's theology. But he does many things, if you read his life, that are rather daring in standing up for the humanistic tradition of university and theological or religious education. Essentially, Erasmus was a man who believed in education. And he didn't see Luther as standing up for education, but for something else. And he also believed in toleration, too. It's very interesting, because here he and Luther did not agree. I think you have to read Huizinga on Erasmus, or quite a number of other biographies. Huizinga is in paperback, and I think if you've ever thought about this, I think it'll become more clear if you read his life. But for our purposes, the most important thing about Erasmus is, again, his textual criticism and his edition of the New Testament, which Luther used in his early commentaries. It becomes very evident in his commentary on Romans, which we have now in a very good and recent English edition, edited by Wilhelm Pauch from Union, in the Library of Christian Classics series, a book that all of you ought to own, along with Luther's Galatians. These are two commentaries that every, well, they're just major commentaries, that's all. Especially in the second part of Luther's commentary on Romans, the fact that he was using Erasmus's text becomes very obvious, rather than the text that he had been using above it. This becomes, Luther used this. He also used Erasmus's edition of Waller's Notes on the New Testament in his work. So for this reason, Erasmus is very important also for the Reformation. Quoted by Luther, refers to him as one of the greatest scholars of his time. Erasmus, I think, something less than complete honesty, says that he had never read a word of Luther, but this was in one of those moments when it looked like humanism and Reformation and everything else was going to go down the drain via the Roman Inquisition, because it's quite obvious from his writings that he had read Luther, as we read them today. I put the other work there, his satire, The Praise of Folly, here just to mention it. I'm sure that you have read it in connection with your humanities course way back there in college somewhere. It's one of those very, very important works of satire that come out of the Renaissance and Reformation period. It's certainly something that we want to mention, that's all. Now, finally, then, in Germany, German humanism. There are quite a number of very important humanists. Conrad Muth, you don't have to put this down, but He was a pastor, a canon, right outside of Erfurt. And many of Luther's colleagues at Erfurt were in Luther's circle. And he was a product of the Platonic Academy in Florence. Later he abjures his Christian faith altogether and becomes something of an agnostic, I suppose, if you want to call him that, in the Reformation period. And he's not at all important, except for the fact that you see how close this most extreme kind of non-Christian kind of humanism was to the school where Luther himself studied. One of the very famous German humanists is John Roy Green, famous because of his textual criticism and edition of the Old Testament. He was a student of Hebrew. He too, however, was a product of the Florentine Academy, a student, in other words, of Ficino and Pico. And then not only does he write commentaries and work with the original Hebrew of the Old Testament, but he also writes a Hebrew grammar, the Rudimenta, which is the first of its kind to appear in Western Europe, and definitely the product of the humanistic, so to speak, the humanistic tradition. Roy Green was not a theologian, he was a layman, just like his son-in-law, Philip Melanchthon. And as a layman, he defended things Jewish. You can always tell when someone on this faculty is interested in Jewish or Hebrew studies, because when the book requests come through for the library, it is usually their initial that is behind books that have to do with Judaism, wherever it might occur in human history. Well, this is the kind of reputation that Roy Green had in Europe. He was one of these Jew lovers, because he was interested in the study of Hebrew and of the Jewish commentaries on the Old Testament and things of that sort. Well, anti Judaism, or the anti-Semitism, I suppose we would say, we'd have to call it that, was rather rampant in Germany, always has been, even until the 20th century. And Reichlin is caught up in this difficulty, because a Jew by the name of Pfefferkorn, who was converted to Christianity, he was a butcher, and was converted to Christianity, was so zealous that he wanted the Inquisition, the Dominican order in Germany, in the area of Cologne and so forth, the cities around Cologne, to burn all Jewish literature, and to require that Christian people, that all people, give up any Jewish books that they have in their possession, to wipe out Jewish scholarship from the face of the earth. Well, needless to say, this would necessarily wipe out all of the rabbinic and Kabbalistic commentaries on the Old Testament, and this disturbed Reichlin very much, and so he comes out publicly against this. He is accused before the Inquisition, appears before it, ultimately appears before Pope Leo X, is exonerated the first time, but then the pressure is so heavy on the ecclesiastical authorities, very similar to the kind of thing that happens today, that Reichlin is asked to go about his business as quietly as possible, and consequently he publishes nothing. This was done by Leo at the behest of Sylvester Prierius, the same man who said that he would have Luther in a prison. Reichlin, as a result of this, publishes his satire called The Letters of Famous Men, which were letters of his supporters to him, which showed, according to Reichlin, the common sense approach to the study of rabbinic and Kabbalistic writings, especially on the Old Testament. Another book, a sequel to this, comes out, The Letters of Obscure Men, which is like The Praise of Folly, one of the masterworks of satire from this period, in which a number of individuals, it's very possible at least that Melanchthon was part of this as a student. It is also very probable that Ulrich von Hutten, the humanistic knight in Germany, was a part of this. In any case, these were letters against what Reichlin stood for, all written in terrible Latin, in worse verse, and a kind of innocuous theology, ludicrous casuistry, as Grimm calls it, to show that by satire, where the common sense approach to the problem was. Reichlin is very important because, again, Luther uses both his grammar and his Old Testament, but especially his grammar in his translating from the Old Testament. Luther uses, by the way, not only Reichlin's efforts, but also many of the earlier translations of the Old Testament into German, produced by the Brethren of the Common Life. I didn't say that yesterday, but I think we probably ought to mention it even here in connection with Reichlin. He also a product of the Brethren of the Common Life, showing how both mysticism and humanism ultimately then influenced the work of Luther in this technical, scholarly sort of way. Ulrich von Hutten, I'm not going to say too much about him. Number three, he was a knight who was very much of a humanist, a rabble-rouser. Nationalism was very, very much a part of his humanism. He wanted to see German studies initiated in all of the universities, very much, I suppose, as you have those who want every school in the United States to have courses in Americanism.
This fellow Putin, there are things about him that one can admire, there are things about him that one does not admire, such as the time when he attempted to kidnap Luther in order to get him to stand with them for German nationalism. A very important figure nonetheless, and one whom Luther knew. And then Philip Melanchthon. We normally don't think of him as a humanist, because he was one of those humanists that actually is far more important, because he was the so-called junior partner of Martin Luther. But here, it's through Melanchthon that the influence of humanism comes most directly to the University of Wittenberg, where Luther taught. And when one reads the remarks of Luther about Melanchthon, one cannot help see that Luther admires this young man because of his humanistic accent. It's quite probable that Luther's approach to the scripture as something that should be understood literally was not native to him. He wasn't trained that way. Melanchthon was. Melanchthon had been trained at Heidelberg, and very much was very much influenced by the humanistic tradition. Melanchthon was a lover of the classics. When he preached his sermon, he would as well have preached on Aristotle. Not because of Aristotle's theology, but just because it was Aristotle. To read Aristotle, to come in on Aristotle, to study Aristotle. This is the great thing in life, you see. A classicist, I suppose we would call him today. And Luther admired this. And if there is an avenue for Luther's, at least his hard talk about interpreting the scripture literally rather than according to the four senses of scholasticism, much of this comes from Melanchthon and from his studies. Melanchthon is the one who understands the term repentance in the New Testament as something other than penance, to be repentant rather than doing penance. It is Melanchthon who understands faith as a relationship term, an attitude toward God or Godward, rather than a subscription to a body of teaching. And this occurs in the theological writings, the first editions of the Loci Communes of Melanchthon, before it occurs even in Luther's writings. Now, these were colleagues, they probably talked about this. Who taught the other is a question, but it's interesting that they occur in Melanchthon's writings before the word studies, you see. The word study approach of humanism to the study of the text. This is the route via which it comes to us, for good or ill. It is far more native to Philip Melanchthon than it is to Martin Luther, to begin with. And then later on in Luther's life, I think there again, all you have to do is compare the first commentaries on the Psalms to the later commentaries on the Psalms. This changes perceptibly. Read a good biography of Melanchthon. Every Lutheran pastor ought to have done this. You hear so much about him in your dogmatics and in your symbolic studies. It is a very fine, if perhaps not very deep, the surface kind of biography by Menschreck on Melanchthon. It's in your bibliography. It's the best one available today in English. The great studies on Melanchthon are in German. If you can study them in German, that you're all right. But there is only one good one in English,
and that's by Mantrek, and that really isn't very good, but it's the best there is.
So, in preparation then for the Reformation, the last point here, I suppose, would be that Luther, obviously Melanchthon, Calvin, Zwingli, Knox, these men were all very much in the tradition, more or less, of humanism. There are certain things that Luther used. He is not a humanist in the same sense that Melanchthon is, because Melanchthon is much more absorbed in the ideals, the goals of humanism than Luther is. Luther simply uses the tools, the best scholarly tools of his day, in order to go about his work. But in any case, he is clearly influenced by this tradition. It is Luther, when he comes to the University of Wittenberg, who introduces the humanistic curriculum of study, especially in theology, if not also in the other disciplines at Wittenberg. Here he is opposed in the first place by Karl Stott. You probably know that story. And then ultimately, when Karl Stott reads up on all of this, he comes to agree with Luther and then carries Luther to extremes that even Luther did not want to go. I think we're almost at our time. There is one more topic to take. We will not be able to do it. We'll have to do it in connection with Luther, and that's the problem of nominalism. Let me say simply that Luther's scholasticism, Luther's education, was the study of Lombard's dogmatics, Peter Lombard from the 12th century, his sentences, but he studied these on the basis of nominalistic commentaries. Now, you remember nominalism from your study of philosophy last year. Not Occam directly, although Occam clearly does influence Luther's. When Luther criticizes scholasticism, what he is criticizing is nominalistic scholasticism, not Thomas Aquinas. Please, gentlemen, just a minute. And he gets his nominalistic scholasticism through Gabriel Biel, B-I-E-L, who was a teacher at Erfurt in the years prior to Luther's coming there as a student. Luther studied under the students of Biel. A very fine work by Heiko Obermann has just come out in the last 6 months on Gabriel Biel. It's the first real study of this man in English, and will be quite helpful in understanding why Luther says things about scholasticism that are clearly not true of St. Thomas. Because he's not talking about St. Thomas. He's talking about the scholasticism that he knew and had studied, which is the Occamistic tradition of scholasticism. What he says about Aquinas is pretty much theological commonplace rather than showing any deep study, much less influence on his understanding by St. Thomas Aquinas. Well, I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to talk about this when we talk about the effort of Luther in reshaping his understanding of the gospel. That's Mantrek. I was looking for the title in my mind, and I couldn't think of it. Yeah, that's Mantrek.